Dr. Dolman, what exactly is the Office of Contract Archaeology?
We are a division of the Maxwell Museum of Anthropology at the University of New Mexico, and just like many academically based cultural resource management outfits, we do contract archaeology or cultural resource management. That means our clients range from state agencies, federal agencies, to private clients that are putting in anything from a 1 acre borrow pit to a 300 mile pipeline.
Well, that kind of answers my next question, which was going to be, what kinds of archaeological projects have you done in the past? Maybe you could give us a couple of examples of typical projects.
Certainly, after 25 years, I've done quite a variety of them. I have never, in fact, worked on a pipeline project, but I've done large cultural resource management surveys for federal agencies, such as about 46,000 acres for the Bureau of Land Management in the El Malpais National Conservation Area, which is associated with the El Malpais National Monument near Grants, New Mexico. My dissertation was based on a series of projects that we did on White Sands Missile Range that were funded by the Strategic Defense Initiative and later the Strategic Defense Command. And that began with a military exercise called Border Star 85, wherein we surveyed 225 square kilometers of the Tularosa Basin floor.
Now, you mentioned contract archaeology. How does contract archaeology differ from purely research-driven archaeology?
Two very important ways. One, it's my understanding, I can't cite anything, but it's my understanding that contract archaeology accounts for somewhere between about 80 and 90% of the money spent on archaeology in the U.S. today, which means it generates a huge gray literature that is unavailable to the public, and it means that contract archaeologists need to do a better job of getting that information out to the public, and they generally don't because they can't build the costs of publicizing contract work into their budgets. The other major difference is that it is driven by mandates, federal law and state law. We don't get to pick our sites like academic archaeologists do. We go and look on the ground where the pipeline is, not where we want to look. But pipelines, coal mines, lots of projects, especially somewhere like New Mexico, where the arid environment means that the archaeology is particularly visible. Just about anywhere you go, you're going to find an archaeological site, whether it's a lithic scatter or a pueblo or something else, a historic stage stop, the Camino Real, all sorts of sites. And essentially what the industry of contract archaeology bases itself upon is that federal laws, and in many cases state laws, mandate that any ground-disturbing activity that takes place on federal land involves federal money, a federal license or a federal easement. Requires that the sites that are going to be impacted be identified through survey, evaluated for National Register eligibility potential through consultation, and then a consultation process involves deciding what to do with sites that aren't potentially eligible and therefore deemed, quote, significant, unquote.
Now, how did you get involved with the Sci-Fi Channel, and what exactly is it that they wanted?
We were first contacted in 1999 by two fellows who are pretty well known in the UFO research community, Don Schmidt and Tom Carey, his partner. They wanted to know what kinds of archaeological methods could be applied to a spot that they thought was the site of one of the Roswell incident crashes. And so back then we gave them a small budget that involved supervising volunteer excavators and searching for pieces of spaceships and evidence of the impact mark, and then they approached us again this year, in about May of this year, 2002, with some financial backing from the Sci-Fi Channel. And so the Sci-Fi Channel figured basically that if they funded this project and then turned it into a documentary, which they did, then they could make some money out of it, and the UFO researchers would do something that, to my knowledge, no UFO researcher has done in the past, which is go out there and see if there's any physical evidence.
Did you have any qualms about getting involved with this project?
Oh, a little bit, but the total unusualness of it was too much to pass up.
Did you approach this as a believer or a disbeliever in visitors from other worlds?
I approached it as an archaeologist being contracted to go out and apply archaeological methods to looking for physical evidence at a place where someone thinks there should be physical evidence, based on eyewitness and hearsay testimony.
Could you just briefly summarize the Roswell story and explain how archaeology can help resolve the question of what happened at Roswell?
First of all, unfortunately, I am not much of an expert in the Roswell story. At the same time, of course, I've picked up a lot and did some reading. Essentially, in the summer of 1947, there were an awful lot of UFO sightings around the country that were making the news. In July, early July of 1947, according to various accounts, something happened that involved a thunderstorm, loud noises, bright lights in the sky. And the day after, either July 3rd, 4th, 5th, or maybe the 6th, a rancher by the name of Mac Brazel went out on the Foster Ranch, where he was the foreman, and was taking his sheep to water when he came across a field littered with weird metallic debris. He eventually was convinced by his neighbors to take that in and showed up in Roswell at the sheriff's office on or about July the 7th and said, "I've got this weird stuff." At that point, the story gets pretty detailed, but essentially the Roswell Daily Record newspaper of July the 8th had a headline that said that the Army Air Force was in possession of a flying disc that had been recovered in the desert outside of Roswell. The next day, the Air Force retracted and said it was just a weather balloon. The mythology, oral tradition, or folklore, if you will, and that's a very important aspect of this whole story, is that it has an anthropological side to it. That developed from that, the reams and reams of paper that you could create from that would probably go around the world, practically. In any event, there was early on a story about a UFO crash in the plains of St. Augustine. There was a claim of people finding a crashed spacecraft at the same time in the Capitan Mountains. There are several sites claimed to be where the craft was found along with the bodies, and of course this is all hearsay evidence, essentially. It's all he said, or my brother told me that his wife talked to a guy who was the son of the rancher's sister-in-law, etc., etc., etc. So a huge myth, folklore, whatever, has grown up around the thing with competing crash sites and competing stories and lots of stories about a government cover-up. And many people, their conviction that it happened seems to be driven as much by what they see as evidence of a cover-up as much as it is by anybody saying that I saw a UFO or a spacecraft. Three folks who were anthropologists and whose names I forget except for the lead author's name was Saylor have written a book called UFO Crash at Roswell, Genesis of a Modern Myth, and they took an anthropological approach to it. And there are a number of interesting parallels between that and other famous things that might be thought of as folklore. For example, just as the church doctrine for the Christian church was developed through by meetings in the early centuries A.D., there were meetings among UFO experts to decide what was true and what was not true about the Roswell incident. And, of course, other than that, you know, it's quite obviously important myth, folklore in the state of New Mexico, and it's got economic and cultural importance to New Mexicans. And that was another reason that I was out there, is that as I began to realize that we're actually looking into an anthropological phenomenon here, despite the whole issue of there being a spacecraft or not.
All right, so you and your team went out there and did some work. Now, you had a research design in mind. What kind of methods did you plan to employ out there, and how does that match the kinds of data that you were expecting to find?
Essentially, the spot that we went to is known as the Debris Field and Skip Site, and it was chosen by the project's technical advisors, otherwise known as the UFO researchers Schmidt and Carey, on the basis of the fact that that's the one spot whose location is most agreed upon amongst the UFO researchers. The overall story is that a craft hit the ground, made a mark, broke up sufficiently that it left some debris behind, then went back up in the air and came to rest finally at the so-called final crash site where the bodies were found something like 20 miles away. And so what we were out there to look for was any debris that might not have been picked up by the government and the furrow or gouge that was left by the glancing blow of whatever impacted the earth there that fateful night of July 4th. People don't totally agree on the exact date. And so the research design that we took to that was basically coming up with methods to find any debris that might have been missed by the government, either because it was snatched up by a pack rat and stuck in a nest, fell into a coyote burrow, or was small enough that it was missed and got subsequently buried by bioturbation, of which there's always plenty in the New Mexico deserts. And the other thing we were looking for was the furrow. And since the furrow was not visible on the surface now, we figured, well, we've got to find a way to find it under the surface. So the first phase of the project involved laying out a grid system that covered an area 120 by 300 meters. The area and its orientation were selected for us by the UFO researchers. Then Dave Hindman in Sunbelt Geophysics went out and ran his EM38 electroconductivity device across it, did a survey, went home, processed the data, and came back with a map, a color-coded relief map showing places of low conductivity and high conductivity. The theory behind that being that if there were a furrow that had been plowed into the ground by the crashing craft that had subsequently filled in by erosion, or possibly the government, that the fill would be softer and more porous and therefore contain greater moisture than the surrounding sediments in which, you know, there had been no disturbance, it hadn't been loosened up in the various and sundry pedogenic processes that plug and compact things had been at work. And so you'd get an anomaly in the form of high conductivity representing the fill of the furrow.
I understand that you had some unusual components to your field methods relating to procedures to prevent people from salting the site. How did that work?
What we did was, prior to the excavation of any grid, we took a record shot showing the surface in its undisturbed condition. Then, if any grid's excavation was not complete at the end of the day, we took a photograph of the bottom of the test pit and then sealed it with plastic, put black plastic down and put through the back dirt in to hold it down. The next morning, we would not let them open their test pits until I was there. They'd pull it out and I'd take another shot of the bottom of the test pit. I made a big point of how this was going to make sure nobody could salt the site, and since the volunteer excavators had really never done any archaeology before, I hopefully that encouraged them to not try. I didn't find any evidence that anybody had made an attempt to salt the site, but you could probably do it if you were really crafty.
Now we get to the question of results. Did you find anything out there that supports the reports of an extraterrestrial craft crashing there?
I found a couple of things that could be. The first thing that I found, let me just run through the rest of the methodology real quick for you. Mr. Hyman also conducted he did in fact find two conductivity highs, and they were right along the line of the furrow that had been pointed out to us, and so we investigated those with test pits and later backhoe trenches. His metal conductivity survey also found a concentration of metal detection hits. The device is called an EM61, I think. I don't know a lot about how it works, but it is considerably more sensitive than your standard look on the beach for rings type of device. And it can pick up metal, and it can also pick up concentrations of heavy minerals. And so we investigated that anomaly with test pits and a backhoe trench as well. And finally, we used a backhoe across the reported center line of the furrow to see if we could find anything in that backhoe trench. And I was at the backhoe trenching took place on the last day. I went to look at the trenches after they'd been dug, and in one of them I found a very unusual feature that was essentially V-shaped, and my first thought was, holy cow, here's a stratigraphic anomaly right where there's supposed to be one. And I was pretty dumbfounded, to tell you the truth. I kept an open mind throughout the whole project, but at the same time, I wasn't really expecting to find anything.
When you were doing your test excavation, what kinds of artifacts did you find exactly in there?
To be quite honest with you, I didn't see very many of them at all. We kind of intentionally, when somebody had found something that qualified as what we called a humuo, which stands for historic material of uncertain origin, and was designed to accommodate anything that wasn't obviously a historic artifact, a Native American artifact, or just a little natural limestone rock. I said, when you get it, just stick it in the envelope and tape it up.
So does that mean you still have artifacts in bags and samples in bags that have not yet been examined?
Absolutely. Part of this other security measure was that at the end of the day, we took our field specimen catalog and the soil samples we had collected along with these humuos, and turned them over to a security team, Fortress Security Inc., and they locked them up in an armored van that stayed on site all night, and the stuff remained under a serial-coded Teflon seal until the next day. And then at the end of the project, that stuff was taken under armed guard into Roswell and is now locked up in a vault.
So when is that going to be examined, and when will we be able to find out what's in the bags?
We're going to be holding discussions next week with the Sci-Fi Channel, because they do want to pursue analysis of this stuff. And the HMUOs themselves, like I say, I saw something that looked like duct tape, except for it didn't have fibers in it. We picked up a weird orange blob that I couldn't identify. I know that there's a few fibers from a nylon grid string in one bag, but the person who dug it up was just totally convinced they had fiber optics.
How have various people reacted to your involvement with this project? Have you been supported or criticized or both?
Both. The archaeological community around here has been pretty supportive and just thought, well, sure, this sounds like a total hoot. New Mexicans for Science and Reason had some things on their website that was fairly negative. Most of that I can trace to people mistakenly thinking that I, somewhere along the line, had said that what I found proved the existence of UFOs. I never said that at all. I said that I found a weird anomaly in a backhoe trench, and also about half a mile away from where we were working, I found a thing that could very easily be described as a furrow on a hillside that is not a road, it's not a cow path, and it's not a drainage channel. But unfortunately, it's also a 1946 photography, so it probably is not a record of something that happened in 1947.
I see. Does this project leave you with any lasting impressions? Are there any lessons that can be drawn for archaeologists or for the public?
I think so. First of all, be very careful what you say to the press. Second of all, the basic hypothesis that underlies this project is that if there was a crash, and this could be the Roswell incident or anything else, that essentially, since it happened 55 years ago, first of all, it's potentially eligible to the National Register. Second of all, it definitely qualifies as an archaeological site. And because of that, there's nothing wrong at all with going out and applying archaeological methods, because that's what we do, the forensic science of the past.
Now, this is a contract archaeology project. How has contract archaeology changed the profession? There are a lot more archaeologists now, aren't there?
Certainly. Prior to contract archaeology, the only people that did archaeology were people in academic settings who were faculty members, essentially, and their students.
Has this expanded our knowledge of the past?
That's a good question. I'd have to say that it shouldn't be answered until the things that we dug up are analyzed. And we, like I said, we got these HMUOs, and we also, and for all I know, they're pieces of tractor parts. I haven't seen them. I really don't know what they are.
Mm-hmm.
The couple that I saw, I couldn't readily identify, but I was also really busy, and I said, stick it in a bag and put it in the log. We also collected soil samples from each of our 10-centimeter levels in case there's microscopic stuff in there that can be detected by a microscopic analysis, or in case there's some kind of chemical or isotopic signature that might tell somebody something.
Well, speaking more broadly, are there built-in conflicts between serving clients and expanding human knowledge? How do you deal with that?
We look at it the same way we look at it when we go out and do a coal mine, a pipeline, or anything else. In particular, when we get hired by a private contractor, like a pipeline company, of course we could save them money by not finding sites. Or if we found sites, we could save them money by saying, oh, we recommend them as non-eligible. And in the long run, all one can do, all the public can do, is hope that the archaeologist adheres to a high standard of professional ethics. And we do that when we do pipelines, and I did that when I went out there and looked for evidence of a crash site.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dolman, for agreeing to this interview. It's been very enlightening.
Thank you.